Lecture 7, Croesus.
Our last two lectures examined the importance of Lycurgus and Solon. Lycurgus, the lawgiver of Sparta, Solon, the lawgiver of Athens. These two city-states, Athens and Sparta, would be the key, the cornerstone of Greek resistance to Persia in that most critical single moment in the history of Greece, perhaps in our own history as well, when the vast empire of Persia, the largest empire the world had yet seen, set itself upon the course of conquering the small, independent city-states of Greece. Only 31 of them stood together, led by Athens and Sparta. Had Greece been defeated, then it is very likely that the idea of freedom as we know it would have vanished from history. It is very likely that our very art and architecture, as we understand it, would not have developed. The richness of Greek tragedy, the whole legacy of the Roman Empire, none of these might have come into being. In these terms, the British thinker of the 19th century, James Mill, said that the victory of Athens at Marathon was more important to the history of England than the Battle of Hastings. The importance of this struggle against Persia was captured in the first true work of history, Herodotus and his Histories of the Persian Wars. A work written in the 5th century, a work born amidst the political innovation of the Athenian democracy, but a concept of history in Herodotus that looked back to our lecture on Pythagoras and Solon, the innovation of learning in the 6th century B.C., and the search for something that is enduring behind all the change. For that is what Herodotus set out to do. Why do great nations rise and fall? He asked the question. He himself was a political exile who had been driven from Halicarnassus in Ionia in Asia Minor, traveled widely, and then come to Athens, where he read his history before an Athenian audience in the year 445. It was a narration before the entire assembly of Athenian citizens. And so pleased were they with his history that they gave him 10 talents as a reward. Now, 1 talent is enough to build a warship. So this made him wealthy forever. He went off to South Italy, lived out his life, but left behind this history, which was so important to the Greeks as a whole, that it was read on a regular basis at the Olympic Games. In it, Herodotus searches for moral truth. And for him, that is the ultimate purpose of history, just as it is for Plutarch, that the reader will be instructed and made better, better as an individual, better as a citizen. And he believes that we can learn as much, perhaps more, from others than from ourselves. And that is why his history has as its true protagonists not the Greeks, but the Persians. They are the ones who are most instructive. And he doesn't begin his history with the outbreak of the Persian Wars. He begins it much earlier. And he roams widely through Egypt, through the cultures of Babylonia, far off to the steppes of Russia, to Scythia, searching for lessons. Yes, there are a lot of anecdotes and stories. Herodotus is sometimes thought of as a garrulous storyteller. Nothing can be farther from the truth. He understood that in order to instruct, you must first entertain. And the stories in Herodotus are woven tightly, like a necklace, from the beginning to the end, bringing us back to central truths. And for Herodotus, the ultimate truth of history is found in the concept of hubris. Outrageous arrogance. In Athenian law, hubris is also the word to describe rape, that worst of crimes against innocence. And hubris is an abuse of power often inflicted upon the innocent, which brings in its train consequences of destruction for the guilty and innocent alike. Aite is another central theme for Herodotus, moral blindness. And those possessed of great power become blind to truth. They cannot be instructed. And so they themselves become the instrument of instruction through their fall from power. And Herodotus introduces us to this theme at the very beginning of his history, starting the tale of the Persian Wars with Croesus, the king of Lydia. In our terms, Croesus reigned from 560 to 546 BC, king over one of the four powers of his world, Lydia, Egypt. The pyramids were now 2,000 years old, but Egypt was living in the twilight, a final golden age of its glory. Babylon, with its hanging gardens and great walls and gates, was a third power. And to the north, in what is today Iran, the kingdom of the Medes, Media. All of these were great powers, believing that they would rule the world forever, divided the world up into spheres of power between themselves, engaging in a balance of power. And Croesus sat at the heart of this world. His very name would become proverbial. A generation earlier from us would understand the term rich as Croesus. The land of Lydia was filled with natural alloys of gold and silver. It was there that coinage was first struck. And Croesus believed, as Herodotus tells us, that he was the happiest man in the world. Now, he had come by his throne in an unusual fashion. And Herodotus starts his tale by explaining how Croesus came to be king. And it raises a question at the very beginning of history of private versus public morality. That, too, interested the ancients. Can a ruler, king or president, commander-in-chief, is their morality as a private individual separate from what they do as a leader? And can we not judge them for private acts of immorality? And do these private acts of immorality have no consequences for the nation as a whole? Well, the king of Lydia, five generations before Croesus, was King Candaules. It's a Lydian name. It means something like dog strangler. And he had a beautiful wife. And he was enormously proud of the beauty of his wife. And he never stopped talking, King Candaules did, five generations before Croesus, never stopped talking about how lovely his wife was. And one day he was telling the head of his bodyguard, Gyges, "My wife's the most beautiful woman in the world, da-da-da-da." Gyges' eyes, just for a moment, glazed over. He'd heard the story so many times. And Candaules says, "You don't believe it, do you?" He said, "Yes, I do, sire. I really do believe it." "No, you don't. And I'm going to prove it to you. I want you to see my wife in the nude." Gyges said, no, I don't want to do that. Please, sire. You know what they say, off with a woman's clothes, off with her shame. No, you are going to see her. I'm going to work it out. She won't even know it. Please, sire, said his head of his bodyguard, "don't ask me to do this." Well, nothing would deter King Candaules. So that night, he arranged for Gyges to be behind a screen. His wife came into the bedroom, took off her clothes. Gyges saw her, then slipped out. But the queen had caught a glimpse of him from the corner of her eye. She said nothing to her husband, but the next day she sent for Gyges. It was not unusual for the queen to send for Gyges, and so he came. She said, "All right, I am giving you a choice, head of the bodyguard. Either you kill my husband and marry me, or I tell him that you came in here and tried to seduce me and he will kill you. What is it going to be?" Well, Gyges said, "Don't make it either one. Let's just forget all of this happened." But, see, Herodotus presents us with this question. Are all things that happen fated by the gods? Or, what Herodotus believes, do the gods simply put us in these situations and we make the choice? And Gyges made his choice. "I'll go along with you. We will kill your husband and I will become king in his place." And so they do. And Candaules is murdered by his own wife, the head of his bodyguard, and Gyges now rules over the land of the Lydians. And from Gyges, five generations later, comes Croesus. Now, the king, Candales, had committed an act of hubris. He had shamed his wife, had he not. She had done nothing to deserve this. And the consequences would be visited not upon the wife, not upon Gyges, but five generations later. For not only had Candales committed hubris, but his wife had committed hubris. She had acted in excess, don't you see? Why didn't she just go to her husband and say, "You shouldn't have done that"? But no, she had responded in an excessive fashion. And that, too, is part of the lesson of Herodotus woven through his history. Nothing in excess. Even punishment can be excessive. But that's all in the past. Croesus is now king over Lydia. And one day there comes to his court a stranger, Solon the Athenian. Remember, having set in place the laws of Athens, he travels. And he comes now to Lydia, sometime after 560, an old man, and presents himself at the court. And King Croesus says, "I have heard of you. You are one of the wisest men of Greece. I have a question for you. First of all, I'd like to have you escorted around my palace and grounds." And the vast wealth is laid out before Solon, the power and might of Lydia, one of the four mightiest men of his day. And he says, when Solon comes back, "Tell me something, Athenian. Who is the happiest man in the world?" Solon thinks a minute and says, "It was Tellus." "Who?" "Tellus." "Tellus. T-E-L-L-U-S. Tellus." "Who is that?" "Well, he was an Athenian." "Yes, so what?" "Well, he was a brave man. He had sufficient money by our standards. He raised up his family, so they were all grown up and with children of their own. And then he died fighting for his country, was killed in battle, and got a public funeral. Such was his bravery." "Well, so what? What makes him the happiest man in the world?" "Well, all right, I tell you what, that must just be mere Athenian pride. Who's the second happiest?" "Cleobus and Biton." "Who are Cleobus and Biton?" "Well, they were two young men of Argos, and their mother was a priestess of the god Hera, and one day she was going off to give sacrifice, and there was no ox to draw her wagon. So her two sons yoked themselves up to the wagon, drew it into town. She offered up sacrifice, and everybody crowded around her and said, 'How lucky you are to have these two fine, brave sons.' And she, their mother, prayed to the goddess Hera, 'Give them the greatest gift.' And that night, they went into the temple, Cleobus and Biton, the two sons. They fell asleep and did not wake up." And that makes them happy? They died when they were at the height of their pride and fame, before life could pull them down. You see the lesson he's given him. First of all, this man Tellus, he had what you should want: a nice family, a good public reputation, and die with that reputation. And these two young men, those whom the gods love, they take back early. Well, Croesus thought that Solon was the most overrated intellect he had ever met. He dismissed him as a fool who did not understand. But before dismissing him, he said, "What about me? Why am I not the happiest man? Sire, right now I would call you a lucky man. But have you ever thought of this? There are 365 days in the year. Each day brings something new. Right now, you are just lucky. No one is happy until the end is known. Look to the end. And when at the end of your days, you still enjoy this fame, this reputation, then I might call you happy." Solon went away. Croesus continued. But he had a dream one night. And in the dream, the gods sent him the message, as he took it, that his favorite son and the heir to the throne would be killed by an iron weapon. Now, you must understand that for the Greeks, including Herodotus, dreams are signs from the gods. They took dreams extraordinarily seriously, and perhaps we are the ones who are foolish to rationalize them. And so Croesus pondered this dream. He had two sons, in fact, but one was unable to speak or hear and never would be suited for the kingship. But the other was the one that Croesus doted upon. And so, in order to make sure the son was never killed by iron weapons, Croesus had all iron weapons removed from the boy's room, took him out of the army where he had been a captain, and had him get married. So he would settle down and live a quiet life. Wouldn't let him go out on any military expeditions anymore, and the boy grieved under this. And one day a group of villagers came in and brought this message to Croesus that a savage boar was ravaging their territory. And would he send hunters to kill the boar? And the boy was there, and he said, "Dad, let me go. I want to go and hunt this boar." And his father said, no, son, not today. And he said, "What have I done to anger you, father? Why are you treating me this way? I was once a soldier, and now you've stripped me of all my honor." And the father said, "No, it's not that, but I had this dream, and you would be killed by an iron weapon." And he said, "Well, Dad, I appreciate that you love me so much, but let me go out. Let me go out and fight this boar, because does a boar carry a sword? Does a boar carry a spear?" "Well, no. Sounds good. All right." So there he is, off chasing the boar, and he's got guardsmen with him to protect him. And the boar suddenly turns in its tracks and races towards the young prince. And one of the guardsmen hurls a spear to stop the boar, misses it, kills the boy. Oh. The word is brought back to Croesus. And maybe, Herodotus suggests, Croesus ought to have stopped right then and reexamined. But he didn't. He continued on because he had more problems, political problems. A great new power was arising on the borders of his country to the east, the new empire of Persia. And Croesus was concerned that it might lead to a change in the balance of power. And so he sought to get the best information that he could. He proceeded prudently. He asked what was the best oracle in the world, the most trustworthy oracle of the gods. For like dreams, Greeks took oracles very seriously. These were ways in which the gods made known their will. And there were a number of them in the Greek world. And so Croesus sent off messengers to each of them, and each one bore the same question. What is King Croesus doing at this very moment? They went off to Dodona, where Zeus spoke in the oak trees. They went off to Egypt, far out into the desert at Siwa, where the Egyptian god equated with Zeus, Amun-Ra, gave his oracles. And they went to Delphi, the oracle of Apollo, deep in the mountains in the central part of Greece. And all of them gave answers, but Apollo alone, to the mind of Croesus, spoke the truth. "I smell," the oracle came back, for each one was to give the question 100 days from the moment of leaving Sardis, the capital of Lydia. "I smell," said the oracle of Apollo, "lamb bubbling up with turtle, and they are doing it in a bronze cauldron." "That's amazing," said Croesus. "I thought of something that no oracle would imagine I was doing. I took a lamb and I took a turtle and I cut them up and I made a stew with my own hands." And the oracle at Delphi knew this. That must be the true oracle. And so he gave enormous gifts to the oracle. Vast sums of money, 117 ingots of gold, a statue 570 pounds in weight of a lion out of pure gold, huge gold and silver mixing bowls, all offered up and given to the god Apollo. As though you could buy the gods. And never questioning in his own mind whether any mortal ought to test the gods. Is that not outrageous arrogance? Is that not hubris? But he went on his way. He asked the god another question. "Will my other son, the surviving son, ever speak?" And the answer came back. "You will rue the day when that son speaks." Next question. Because the empire of Persia has grown so large under a vigorous king, Cyrus, should I march against the Persian empire? Should I march against the Persian Empire? And the answer comes back. If you march against the Persian Empire, a great kingdom will be destroyed. Well, ambiguous, wouldn't you say? But Croesus is a prudent man. And he writes back again and says, well, how long will I be king over Lydia? And the answer comes back, until a mule sits upon the throne of Persia. Well, now, doesn't that sound definite to you? Yes, indeed. So I'm going to, when is a mule going to be king over Persia? So I'm going to march against them. And so the decision is made. And off he goes, taking with him his army. Now, Persia and King Cyrus have done nothing to merit this invasion. They have not threatened the frontiers. This is all an act by Croesus, a preemptive strike. You might think it's wise policy, but you might also think that it is an act of outrageous arrogance to begin this war. But off goes the army of Croesus. And Cyrus responds, and the two meet in the eastern part of Lydia, having crossed really out of the frontiers, and it is a drawn battle. Neither side wins. And Croesus then withdraws, comes back to his capital of Sardis, and assumes that the campaign is over for the year. It has been fought in the fall of 547. Because in those days, it was very difficult to campaign during the winter. The rain made the roads all but impassable. So Croesus comes back, begins to look for allies among the other powers. But suddenly, Cyrus moves his army out through the winter rains and appears before the gates of Sardis. And there's nothing that Croesus can do but to fight. Most of his army has been dismissed. He brings out his cavalry. In those days, the Lydians were famed for the courage of their cavalry. But the army of Cyrus has with it camels, and horses will never go up against camels. They break and run. And so the victory is won by the Persians. Well, still, Croesus is safe within his city walls. And he waits out the siege. But a Persian soldier going around looking up at the walls notices a Lydian standing on the top of the walls whose helmet suddenly falls off and it rolls down the hill. Sardis is situated on a great high hill, and he comes down. And he can come down and get his helmet and then very easily go back up. So that must be the path. And so the Persians assault up that citadel, capture it, and Sardis is in their hands. And up and down the streets of Sardis, they plunder and burn and destroy. And Croesus is running for his life, holding by the hand the one remaining son, the one who cannot speak or hear. And Cyrus, king of the Persian, has given the order that his troops can kill any Lydian they want except Croesus. He wants him alive. And so they're racing along, and suddenly a Persian soldier grabs Croesus, who is in disguise, and starts to kill him. And the little boy speaks out, remember, you will rue the day that your son speaks. You will rue the day. And the little boy shouts, do not kill him, for this is Croesus, king of the Lydians. And so Croesus is brought before the conquering Cyrus. And Cyrus asks him, why did you invade my country? Why did you invade my territory, ravage my lands? And Croesus said, well, the god told me to do it. It's not my responsibility. And he said, you can't shirk your responsibility. You are going to pay for it. I am going to burn you alive. And so a great funeral pyre is built. And this captured the imagination of the Greeks. We have a vase in which the funeral pyre of Croesus is portrayed. And a Persian is there putting a torch to it. So Croesus is on top of this funeral pyre. And Cyrus the Persian is watching this, and the flames begin to go up and lick the logs and get closer and closer and closer. And Croesus shouts out, what did I do to deserve this? Oh, Solon, Solon, Solon. Cyrus says, what? What did he say? I don't know. You, Lydian, what did he say? Solon, Solon, Solon. What does that mean? I don't know. You, Croesus, what are you talking about? Well, I would love to tell you, but I'm catching on fire here. Put the fire out. But it had gone too far. And suddenly, Croesus says, God Apollo, if anything I have ever done pleases you, put this fire out. Put an end to it. And suddenly, out of a bright blue sky, Herodotus tells us, clouds came up, the rain came down, and the fire was put out. All right, come down and talk to me, says Cyrus. Now, what is this Solon? Well, Solon was a wise man who visited me, and I wish he could talk with every king in the world. For he gave me such wisdom, and I spurned it. He said, no one is happy until the end is known. Oh. I tell you what, said Cyrus, you seem as though you have learned a great deal. You have learned wisdom through your defeat and suffering, Croesus. I'm not going to burn you alive. I'm going to make you my honored advisor. Can you give me some advice? Oh, I can, sire. What are those men doing? Ha ha! They are burning your city of Sardis to the ground. No, King Cyrus. They are burning your city of Sardis to the ground, because it is yours now. How? Oh, that is wisdom. I tell you what. Such good advice deserves a favor in return. What would you like to do? Tell you what I would like to do, said Croesus. I would like to write to the god Apollo and ask him why he betrayed me. Do it. So the question went off, and Apollo wrote back and said, first of all, I did not betray you. You asked me if you should march against the Persian Empire, and I wrote back, if you did, a great kingdom would be destroyed. You were the one who was so swollen with hubris. So sure you knew everything, because you see, that is the greatest source of hubris. Thinking you are wise when you are not wise. So you went ahead and acted. I'm going to tell you something else. You thought you could buy with money and gifts the favor of the gods. That can never be. Only one thing, and this is a very important step in morality and ethics, only one thing wins the favor of the gods. And that is a righteous and just life. A life that is not marked by the sin of hubris. Now, I think I paid you back well. Even after you had lost your kingdom through your own folly, I sent the rain that saved your life. So learn from this. What about, Croesus said, the very fact that you told me I would rule until a mule sat upon the throne of Persia. Ah, but you see, the oracle wrote back, you didn't follow that either. You must pursue wisdom, but within limits. And so Herodotus ends the story of Croesus, giving us just one final paragraph to make us think. He tells us that Croesus, when he came to power, had been resisted by one man in his realm, man of wealth and power. And Croesus had taken this man, defeated him in battle, broken him politically, and then had him carded alive. Do you know what that means? How you card wool? He had had that man drawn back and forth until the man was flayed alive. That's excessive. Had Cyrus acted towards Croesus in an excessive manner? No. He started to burn him alive, but then learned and practiced moderation. And for that reason, in the pages of Herodotus, Cyrus is the model of a good king. Herodotus goes on to describe the customs of Lydia, the natural resources, what the Lydians, their festivals. And then he says, the Lydians prostitute their daughters. They send their daughters out to be prostitutes before they're married. Apart from that, Herodotus says, they're just like us. Well, a Greek reading or listening to this being narrated would say, what? What do you mean, just like us? How can anyone who prostitutes their daughter be like us? So Herodotus puts up a flag It is not a flag we would necessarily like, but the Greeks believed that they were fundamentally different from people like the Lydians. And he is saying that despite their external similarities, they are different. They are different from us, above all, in the fact that we, the Greeks, believe in freedom. And the ultimate hubris of Croesus, Herodotus says, was that he was the first foreigner to rob the Greek cities of their liberty. But you ask me, wait a minute. I'm still not sure about this mule. How did a mule get to be king over Persia? And to answer that, we'll come back in our next lecture.